Today is the 19th of October. We are in Munich, and it's the third time that AWE is back in Europe. And it's the first time that Charlie Fink appeared, the first time here on the show. And not just him, but a whole kind of, how should I say, agenda about the future of VR and AR. But first, we are going to speak about himself. Charlie, just present yourself, please.
Sure. My name is Charlie Fink. I'm an AR VR consultant, professional speaker, columnist for Forbes.com, and author of Charlie Fink's Metaverse, an AR-enabled guide to VR and AR.
First of all, I would like to know, what made you decide to work on this topic?
My work on this topic began in 1992 at Disney, and I was involved with Virtual World Entertainment, which was the world's first VR arcade. We used cab-based simulation to network players into environments like a desert planet where they drove a mech and battled. That was our most popular title, BattleTech. We had another title called Red Planet, where you were racing a hovercraft on Mars. And I left that company. That company turned me into what passed for a digital media executive in 1995. And I went to America Online as a senior vice president in charge of their original content. I worked at AOL through 1999. Then I left and started doing, I did a startup, which I sold to American Greetings in Cleveland, and served as their president and then chairman for about 4 years. After that, I wanted to get back to my first love, which was entertainment. And I produced and was involved with 30 Broadway shows in 10 years. But then I woke up one day, I guess this would be the end of 2015, and I thought, God, being a producer is a shitty job. All you do is raise money and argue about money. It's 5% creativity and 95% what to me felt like drudgery. And, you know, I wasn't feeling good about myself. I was feeling very isolated. I was feeling very alone. And I felt like I was hitting myself every day in the head with a hammer. And I don't like waking up in the morning and not feeling like I'm good at what I'm doing. So I stopped. I was able to stop. It was a little bit like quitting a drug because, you know, my identity and a lot of my relationships were tied up in it, and I was afraid of being alone. But I started writing again. I didn't quite know what I was going to write about. I wrote about theater and movies and social media. So, of course, Online Greetings was social media before there was social media. In fact, so was AOL. We just couldn't see it, right? It just took a perceptual shift to see it as Facebook. So really, you know, Facebook became what AOL could and should have been. Ironically, one of the last things I did at AOL, I digress, but this is a good story. I thought we should have a business card site where people could put their business cards in a little bio and connect with each other, both by geographically, both by profession. And they came back and said, no one will buy advertising on that site. We don't want to do it. Of course, someone came along a couple of years later and created LinkedIn. So, you know, a lot of it is driven by your point of view and your context. So I was getting crickets about my writing. It was great to exercise that muscle again. I had studied writing in college. Well, it was not my major, but I certainly started out thinking that it would be. When I was in college, of course, writers still mattered. You know, the written word still had some authority in our society. But I perceived that the world was changing and that attention was going to shift to television and other visual media. So I changed my major, became a film major. And in fact, that happened. And I had another insight in the 90s when I was a motion picture executive that the imagination of the public was going to shift to personal computers. And that turned out to be true also. Although when I had that epiphany, I had no idea the internet was coming. So that was just a very happy accident from which I profited greatly. Although having acquired that wealth also left me free to make stupid mistakes, which I did in abundance. Fortunately, I'm still married and have wonderful children, so it didn't turn out that badly for me, because I had a lot of margin for error. But there I was alone, I was getting nowhere. I, you know, was going to see all the guys who worked for me. Jim Bankoff runs Vox Media now, one of the most successful new media sites, or networks, I should say. And my problem was, you know, Jim's point of view is, look, Charlie, I mean, you're a legend. You had a great career. You're a producer. People are jealous of you. Why would you want to come back into the game? And not only that, but nobody hires their dad. And not only that, but dude, you're irrelevant. Nobody knows you anymore. What would you do? So I took that as a punch in the stomach. It was very difficult news to hear, but it was true. So I focused on the writing, and a friend of mine from the VR days of the 90s was running VR and AR for Honda, and he gave me a lecture that went something like this. You were Mr. VR in the 90s. VR is exploding. Why aren't you in the middle of it? Oh, I can't go back again. I don't know anything about head-mounted displays. The VR we were doing was different. It was all about entertainment. It was a theme park ride. And he goes, no, you don't get it, man. It's completely different. And there's this thing called AR. Do you know what AR is? No, I have no idea what AR is. He goes, well, it's kind of VR, but you also see the real world at the same time. Okay, well, I didn't understand a word of that. But one thing I have learned, and it took me about 55 years to learn it, is to listen to the universe, right? It's not about what I like or what I want to do. It's about what needs to be done. And it's about listening to the messages that come to you instead of letting them bounce off and having blinders on because of what you want to do. And that affected my career as a producer. I did not make the best choices. I didn't pick the best shows because I thought it was about what I liked. So I started writing about VR again, researching. I'm good at researching and writing, right? I'm a tool, honestly. I mean, I'm somebody who stayed all night in the library in college, not because there was going to be any great benefit to my grades, but that I wanted to be an expert in a topic. So I could go down a rabbit hole and stay there for days and come out and at least be conversationally knowledgeable about really any topic. But it served me well as a writer. Within 8 weeks of writing about VR, I got a call from Forbes. And they said, do you want to cover VR and AR for us? And once you have the Forbes brand behind you, everything changes, right? Everybody wants to be your friend. Everybody returns your calls. All of a sudden, you know, waves of, you know, free crap started showing up at my house. My wife says that my office looks like the Amazon returns room threw up in there. And I even know what to do with this stuff. I don't want to resell it, but I don't want to throw it away. You know, so when people try to send me stuff, I'm like, if you send it to me, you must have return mailing in the box and return mailing where they come and get it, not where I have to go somewhere and send it to you, just as an aside. So I mean, it just gives you a sense of the power of the brand. It wasn't the power of Charlie Fink. And after writing for Forbes for 6 months or so, a publisher friend of mine came to me and said, let's do a VR book. His pitch was, look, you've got all these columns, just collect them together and you have a book. And, you know, the book will confer tremendous legitimacy on you. So let's do this thing. So I said yes. I said yes before I really wrote a table of contents and realized that most of the content I needed for the book I actually had not yet written about. Knowing that I really only had about 2/5 of the book or could conceivably write maybe half the book in the time allotted, I had to recruit category experts who had the advantage of not having to do the research that I need to do to write about a particular topic. So you have Ori Inbar talking about the AR cloud since he invented the term. That turned out to be actually a great strategy because it too conferred a tremendous amount of legitimacy on the project. I wanted it to be an AR-enabled book. I thought you can't write a book about AR without it having AR in it. And I was introduced to Living Pop-Ups, which is a company that specializes in AR animation, and they wanted it. They wanted to do cartoons for the book. They're like New Yorker cartoons, but you access them through smartphone and markers, so it's marker-based augmented reality. Of course, building the app was not free, and I had to pay for that out of my pocket because the publisher was like, I'm not going to sell more books because you did that, so you pay for the app. Fortunately, I've made enough money on the book at this point that I could cover the cost of the app, but that is the problem with apps, augmented reality books, and publishing. They make the book much more expensive. The economics are already terrible, so we're not going to see too many augmented reality books as a result. We'll see more, but you won't see too many because the publishing business model is bad, and having to build an app along with making a book would destroy what is left of it as a business. So the fact that it's visual and the fact that it's augmented brought a lot of attention to it. You know, there are lots of books written about VR, but this book was special. I also learned that augmented reality, which was a much bigger topic, and I really started unpacking AR as a result of writing that first book. You know, I was very VR-oriented at that point. That was my background. It's easy to understand relative to AR, which has a lot of nuance, which VR does not, right? VR is VR. AR is we're talking about the evolution of man, right? If you really peel away the layers, we're talking about better humans. Smartphones are AR. Frankly, a pitchfork is AR. It makes man better. Computers, airplanes, the steam engine, all these things augment us. You know, that is, as much as man seeks immersion and entertainment and books and other kinds of media, man also seeks to make his life better, make himself smarter, make himself a better learner and a better worker and a better human. And I do believe that that is happening and that we are seeing it. But I also have some other perspectives that I think are unique. Number one, I am an old guy at this point. I hate to admit it. I don't feel that different, but, you know, I am an old guy at this point. And so I understand how long these changes take. So when a 25-year-old CEO tells me about augmented reality glasses we're going to be wearing in 5 years, I laugh because it's happening right away, but right away to me is 20 years. Right away to him is 5 minutes. And you can't tell that to anybody, right? That's something you have to experience, right? I can't explain it to a young person. Life will explain it, right? I wish I knew that when I was that age, but nobody could tell me anything, and I don't have any illusions that anybody's going to listen to me, right? Because life does that work for us. But I do think that I stumbled into an industry which has got a complicated story to tell and does it really poorly. This industry needs an explainer in chief. So I kind of stumbled into that role, and I felt needed. And the response to the book has been overwhelming and deeply gratifying. When I see pictures of myself with lines of hundreds of people to get a signed copy of my book, I don't even think it's me, you know. And being at these shows is a little bit embarrassing for me because I'm old and bald and have a funny beard, so I'm easy to recognize, you know, and my little picture is there next to my column, and it's really kind of crazy how all of this has happened. So I thought this time, this year, I would be rewriting my first book, you know, updating it, because it's out of date so quickly. In fact, the second page of the book says, warning, this book is out of date. And I realized the sins of the book are sins of not commission or sins that have been caused by rapid developments of technology, but they're sins of omission. And there's so much happening in augmented reality that is not talked about in the first book. And I really don't have that much more to say about virtual reality. Virtual reality is waiting for its AOL moment while it does great things in training and education and will continue to develop for location-based entertainment. But for the consumer, you know, again, we all thought, oh, they're tethered. Oh, they're attached to PCs. Oh, there's not enough content. But as it turns out, it's more fundamental than that. People don't know what VR is for if it's not a game machine, and no one can explain it because it is something that is so specifically experiential that until you've experienced it, it's an abstraction, especially if you're not even technically oriented. So for most people, it's an abstraction. They're not going to buy it. If it's a dollar, they're not going to buy it. They're not going to buy it because they don't want to do it, because they don't see a way that there's a benefit to them, right? Consumers do things for the benefit, right? That's it. You know, they take a personal computer, oh, it does email, oh, it does e-commerce, great, I have to have a personal computer. But before that, nobody thought they had to have one. So I don't have that much more to say about VR. I wish I did, because I love VR, but I think it is on a very slow road, and I don't know how anyone is going to change that. I mean, if somebody could figure that out, I'd be writing about them, and I would be amazed and, you know, very excited, but I don't think it's happening. I think we're kidding ourselves. You know, Oculus Go is bragging about selling 1 million Oculus Go's, you know, in 8 months. Nintendo sold last Christmas in the United States alone in 3 weeks 12 million Nintendo Switches. So that just should put in contrast for anybody who thinks that the Oculus Go is some kind of breakthrough that's going to help the industry. I've heard several people say that the Go is really affecting the industry. And I kind of laugh because, like, the Pico Goblin sold 5 times more than that in China. It also is an interim device, in my opinion. So I'm now writing a book on AR called The World Will Be Painted with Data, a deep dive into the many modes of AR. The world will be painted with data was something I started saying in my talks. And actually, Tom Emmerich, who's one of the organizers of AWE and Ori's partner in Super Ventures, which does early stage investing in AR companies, said to me, there's something about that painted with data phrase. You know, there's something about it that's really compelling. And he also encouraged me to write another book. But the business model for books is so bad. And the, you know, the problem with any kind of a computer book, even my current book, which I think is still in date 8 months later, thank God. So we sold 10,000 copies. Well, that's amazing for a computer book, right? I mean, that's unprecedented for a computer book, especially from an indie publisher. But when you think about what the ambition of the book is, you know, which is educating people about AR and VR and introducing them to this amazing topic, which has so much depth. You know, we're on the cusp of a wealth creation opportunity that is certainly as big as the smartphone, and maybe it's as big as the internet itself. I've heard many people say that. It would be pretty incredible because I didn't think I would ever live to see something like that again in my lifetime, no less be in the middle of it. So the business model is broken for books. And again, I went into debt on my other book, making an app. So I started to float this idea of doing a sponsored book, right? In other words, all the companies here are paying me to write a book. That solves one problem. That solves the business problem for me personally. But it does create a secondary problem, which is now these companies become sponsors. And what does a sponsor want? A sponsor wants exposure. So exposing yourself to 10,000 people and also the 10,000 people that you're already talking to, it's not going to move the needle. So, I mean, companies were willing to come in anyway just because they want a relationship with me, which is, again, tremendously flattering and imbues me with a deep sense of responsibility. So I had the idea that the sponsors should give the book away for free. But not in a way that's normally done on the internet. The way it's normally done on the internet is, I will trade you this ebook for your email address. So I don't want to do that. I want somebody to go to an e-commerce site and see that it's a $50 book. And then by using the code provided by the sponsor, let's say the code is PTC, they get the book for free. Now they feel like PTC gave them a free $50 book, which is what Reflect is doing here at the conference. So that's the business model. It's not like I don't write about companies that aren't sponsors, but the sponsors do get some special consideration. They get a sidebar which describes their company. They're in the featured in the company directory. We're doing an online company directory where they'll be featured. They'll be, you know, featured in the app. And then when I do the use case section, because the enterprise AR section is going to be a 50-page section full essentially of use cases. So whose use cases am I going to focus on? I'm going to focus on the use cases from the sponsors. There are other use cases, and if they're compelling enough, I'll use them. I'm not in the business of excluding people, but if you want to be top of mind and you really want to make sure that you are treated in with priority, then it makes sense to be a sponsor. But I do try and tell people it's not a pay per play. It's a pay for friendship. I don't want to exclude a lot of important companies past for whatever reason, but I'm not going to exclude them from the book. I'm not going to penalize them. But if it's a choice between, oh, I need a picture on this page, the picture is going to come from one of the sponsors, and that's just natural. And it would be completely invisible to the reader, wouldn't matter to them really, because all the pictures are the same. You know, all the pictures of a guy holding up a pad looking at a motor. So that could be anybody's picture. So it'll probably belong to a sponsor. And the business is really working. I've had so much inbound because, you know, it's gotten to the tipping point because there are 25 companies sponsoring it now. So I actually have companies coming to me saying, why haven't you pitched us on sponsorship? So I don't actually have time to write the book and sell sponsorships. You know, I mean, it's great. I mean, the industry needs an explainer-in-chief, and there's a pain point in the sales process that everybody shares, which is you come into a client, big industrial manufacturing concern, you could easily see how AR, even the most simplest applications, could save them tremendous amount of money on mistakes, inefficiencies, less downtime in factories. You know, it could be transformative even applied in its crudest ways. But those companies don't know what they don't know, and they don't want to be told it by a salesman. A salesman is not a teacher anyway. So I think I'm going to start a consulting practice when the other book is done, focused on XR education, but not the people in the industry. They don't need the education. It's the people who are their potential clients. So they could conceivably be people who would provide leads, and then I would have programs for companies for executive education in XR. And I'm trying to programize it so I don't have to be the one always delivering it, right? So it would be a day of, you know, lectures and seminars. You take a couple weeks in between and you do some webinars with thought leaders. And then you come back in and you do some breakout sessions with smaller numbers and smaller teams just on a whiteboard. Like, if we had AR for you, where would you use it? And then you package all that up in a white paper for management. And that's a pretty substantial product, especially if you're doing it for several hundred people. And for me personally, it's scalable because I can't scale my writing business. I can't scale my education. I can't scale my speaking business. I can't scale my consulting business if I'm the one who's providing the services. So this seems to me to be the way to broadly distribute the book, the ideas in the book, and provide what the industry needs. And I'm just listening to the universe. Like, I didn't want to start a consulting business. I didn't want to do executive education. I didn't know that there was some job called explainer-in-chief, but it found me because I'm relevant.
Before the explainer-in-chief, we had the evangelizer, right? And then
you could call me an evangelist also. I call myself skeptical fanboy. Yeah, I mean, evangelists are important because companies need thought leadership, and companies need people who are not operating the company but thinking about their position in a larger world. So I think it's valuable for companies at the right stage of maturity to have an evangelist. To evangelize for the whole industry, well, that's what we do all together. You know, I don't think that's one person becomes an evangelist for the industry, or that I have enough celebrity to be that person anyway. But I do think I'm the person that a large industry or a large company with multiple factories and multiple products could look to and say, help us understand the opportunity.
But we have the IEEE next to us. So if we have the explanatory chief, if we have evangelizer, what will be the third upcoming E after that period?
I don't know, maybe the E in Charlie. I mean, the IEEE is another organization which has a tremendous amount of problem explaining what they do to somebody who's not inside. If you told them what the IEEE did, still wouldn't understand. That's who I'm talking about, right? Because that's the guy who is a manager of a manufacturing company where he's got people doing assembly and he's does human resources. I mean, how are you going to teach that guy about AR? You're going to give him a book to read, right? Because he doesn't get paid to read books. But if you had an executive education program, and you made it fun, and you made it interesting, and you did demos, and you showed off equipment, then he would walk out saying, oh, I get it now. I understand what augmented reality is. So I think that's a service that needs to be provided if AR is going to grow. And again, I'm talking about enterprise now, because it's not ready for consumers, really, other than mobile phones. It's going to be a while. We have the Magic Leap fantastic technology, and they've built a terrific company with really smart people, but it's going to take, as we talked about a few minutes ago, these things take time. It's going to take longer than Magic Leap thinks or Magic Leap wants. And there's going to be lots of competition, right? Because the technology barriers aren't going to be there forever. I mean, I'm excited about Magic Leap. It's a fantastic story. I mean, I like telling stories. You know, the Magic Leap story is a great story, as is the story of the HoloLens. But again, are we really talking about a piece of hardware? Or are we really talking about the infinite possibilities of man? That's what gets me up in the morning.
I will try something different than usually because you made a very easy job for me. I don't have to ask that many questions. So I first will summarize what you said in a very simple picture. I think you have been sending many boats into the sea even whilst you were at AOL. And I remember you because we were involved in starting AOL in Germany. And actually, AOL was the first gatekeeper for network, not just for technology, or not just for contact, but for the network. AOL in Germany was the first network operator in Germany besides Deutsche Telekom. Nobody understood that. So I remember you having been in this place. Now, at that time, you did send many ships into the sea, and they were all more or less, they were sunk. And now what I see is you having been a refugee on a kind of lifeboat, which is going to become a big, big steamer. And you really have enough of a problem with not being the captain of a steamer you have never dreamt of being one.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just listening to the universe. You know, you're on a boat with a lot of people and somebody needs to steer it. And everybody's looking at everybody else. And I'm the kind of guy who says, well, if nobody else knows how to steer it, I'll take a chance I'm not doing it with intention. I'm doing it out of recognizing needs. I mean, I went into this, I'll tell you, I thought, what qualities do I want to have as a writer? Like, before I ever thought about being a professional speaker or writing a book, what kind of writer do I want to be? And the first thing I realized is that most writing, particularly technology writing, is really snarky. And there's no reason for that other than the writer amusing themselves at the expense of entrepreneurs. So I thought that was wrong, even though it's often very entertaining. The point, yes, as a writer, you need to entertain, right? Just like anybody else, you need to seduce your audience. But to do it at the expense of the subject seemed to me to be counterintuitive, right? Because if I think the subject is such an idiot, why would anybody read what I'm writing, even if it is entertaining? So I think snark is good for short-form kinds of journalism. And now that, of course, I'm inside the business, I understand what happens, right? You're a writer. You get paid $50,000 a year. You have to rewrite 5 press releases every day. And, you know, your life really is pretty sucky. And, you know, by the time it's 4 o'clock on Monday and you've got to write one more story, you're like, you know, fuck these fucking people. And you write something snarky. So I didn't want to be that guy, right? And I also didn't want to write negative stories because I don't get paid that much at Forbes, right? I don't do scoops. If somebody comes to me with some Me Too thing, I'd run the other direction. I don't want to, you know, sometimes I interview an executive and I really don't like them, so I don't write about them. I don't take revenge through my writing. It actually came from my learning in social media, which was completely separate from VR, AR, and writing, that you have to be of service. You know, you have to be of service and you have to expect nothing. Service is like generosity. Generosity with strings attached is self-interest. And you never get anything for doing that, including the satisfaction of having been selfless and generous. So I tried to, without guile and without ambition, just to be of service and share knowledge. And when I had an insight, which, you know, again, I mostly reflect the thinking of people much smarter than I am, who I talk to all day long, which is the great thing about my job. I don't have that many original insights. But when I do, I have a way to share them, and I just give them away. And that has come back to me tenfold. But it still guides everything I put out there in social media, because I think what I found was, and this is actually straight out of Gary Vaynerchuk's book, eventually you've built relationships. And when you have relationships, then you can ask for the sale. And it's a natural outgrowth of the relationship, and it isn't viewed as intrusive. And it isn't done so frequently and in a way that people are like, oh, that's why Charlie does this. You know, instead, it's, I want to buy Charlie's book because I really like the guy, and I know that he's like Switzerland. He has no dog in the fight, right? I prefer no company over another. I prefer no technology over another. I'm just an enthusiastic fanboy trying to figure out what's going on and then tell the truth in a way that is accessible to people who are outside of our industry. By the way, my wife does not think I've achieved that. She thinks everything I write is for nerds. So speaking of my wife, she does say some really great things like, you know, she's, why do you love these conferences? I'm like, I'm like a celebrity. I'm famous to 5,000 nerds and they're all here. My wife has been long suffering. She's gone through many transformations and career changes and industry changes. And I certainly wouldn't be where I am and free to be who I am if I didn't have that support. You know, I dedicated my book to her. She hasn't read it. She read, like, the introduction. She's like, wow, this is heady stuff. And she's been carrying the book around with her for a year almost. So maybe that's more meaningful to me than her actually reading it.
I have two more questions. The first is still simple. The second one will be a mental pleasure for you.
Okay.
The first one is sort of simple because when I started to be involved in the AWE thing, we had a lot of debate about how these subjects are going to be treated in the U.S. and how they're going to be treated outside the U.S. Now you're traveling more and more abroad. Have you seen major difference between the reception in the U.S. and abroad, especially in Europe and in Asia? Or in the end, are they all the same?
I can't speak to Asia. I have not done enough work there. And in fact, in my book, I talk about the development of immersive technologies in China and the advantages that the Chinese system, which is a combination of top-down control and entrepreneurship on a corporate culture, you know, they have advantages in an environment where there is rapid technological change. But I had relied on Anika Steiber to teach me that. She's a researcher who spent a lot of time looking at Chinese companies. She's written several books on the topic. And so I was fortunate that she agreed to contribute because, again, that is something I have no knowledge about. So I don't have that much experience with Chinese companies other than dealing with them at CES, which I presume is the worst possible environment in which to evaluate them. But I do have some insight into Europe and the United States. First of all, Europe is a lot smaller, so it's a tighter community. People know each other, you know, in Germany who are doing AR. So I don't think that's really true in the United States. It's a much bigger place. But I do think that there is a general progressivism in European culture and a little more openness toward new things that is kind of like California in the United States. It's not a conservative place. It's not a place where change makes people run around like the sky is falling. But I do think there is another America which is less progressive and understands the future a little less or a little differently. So, you know, technology is a threat. Intellectuals are not to be trusted. People who work in universities are communists or whatever they think they are. So I think the United States is, you know, in that way, you go to California, you go to AWE in Santa Clara, you think, oh my God, the United States is way ahead of everybody else. But then, you know, then you come to AWE in Germany, it's like, yeah, it's smaller, but it's happening here. There are most of the industrial use cases that I know of are in Europe. There's a lot. I mean, there's plenty in the U.S. It's not like there are none, but considering the size of Europe, there are a lot, right? Europe is like a quarter of the size of the United States, something like that. It's a combination of all these countries is a quarter of the size of the United States, yet look at how much is going on here. So I do think that progressive cultures like there is in California or like you find here in Germany or Ireland are really Scandinavian countries, Israel, I mean, these are all countries which will rapidly embrace change more than we're seeing in the United States. The United States has become a country that is very resistant to change, and where change is often viewed as a negative word. And I think that puts the country and the country's industries at a huge disadvantage, not only versus China, but versus Canada, but versus Europe. So those are negative trends. And the trend toward defunding education in the United States is a very negative trend. The Chinese, 10 years ago, decided they wanted to have an army of programmers larger than the People's Liberation Army. And today they do. When's the best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago. When's the second best time? Now.
Charlie, after all these insights, I told you the last question will be a little different. Imagine all the questions I could have asked, but I didn't. Imagine one of those questions and give me your answer, this question you would have liked to imagine to be your question.
I think the hardest question is the one to which there is no answer. Right? So sometimes we have to be people who ask good questions, not people who have answers. And that's very hard to accept for me. You know, people love math because there's an answer. One thing I learned in art school is there are only choices, there aren't answers. And so you look at this and you say, where is it going? And we are going to an augmented future. I don't know if that's going to be a future that belongs to Magic Leap. I don't know if that future belongs to the United States or Canada or China. So that's what makes it such a great story to tell, right? Because you've got larger-than-life characters, you've got the biggest companies in the world, you've got geopolitical forces that are influencing how technology is developed and who develops it and who uses it. So, you know, this is a very, very, very big topic. You know, that's, again, why my new book is about AR and has nothing to do with VR, because AR is woven into everything. And, of course, that's why eventually we'll stop using the word AR. It's just going to be baked into better apps and better machines and better man-machine interfaces. It's impossible to know enough about any one of these topics to give a global perspective on it. But the ambition is to chronicle what's happening at this moment, because it's really a path that we're on. It's a path that started before you and I were born. It's a path that's going to go on throughout my children's lifetimes. And it's the natural outgrowth of man's curiosity and quest. So I don't think there's any way to really tell the story. And I don't think that there's an end point where we say, oh, we now live in an augmented world. Oh, it's augmented reality. I think we have to accept that there is no answer and that it is really just life that we're talking about. In our case, the tech life, which is one aspect of this larger picture.
Charlie, thank you so much for your insights. It really was a pleasure talking to you. And you made my life very easy. And hopefully you made...
It's always good to talk to other writers because they know what story to tell. It's other people's stories that are harder to tell because they didn't construct them as a story.
Thank you again. And it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Wolf. Yeah.